This is Break the Case with Jennifer Coffendaffer. Inside the evidence, behind the headlines, from someone who's been there. Here now, Jennifer Coffendaffer.
True crimers, welcome to Break the Case. I'm your host. I'm Jen Coffendaffer. Listen, I don't know if I've ever perhaps been more excited about a show than this show. This is going to really give some highlight into an area that is the furthest thing from my expertise when I was an FBI agent, and that is in the cyber profiling realm. This was so new, and who we have with us is Cameron Malin. Let me tell you just a touch about him. He is a publicized author. No, not a self-author. This guy publishes because people want to know what he has to say. In addition, he was an attorney with the United States Attorney's Office prior to becoming an FBI agent. And then I guess he wanted to get into the true mix on the ground, boots on the ground, ended up becoming a behavioral analysis unit agent profiler and developed the first unit that incorporated really the cyber footprint to analyze behavior and basically profile from that optic. How cool is that? So anyway, I cannot wait to bring him on stage, so I'm not going to. Without further ado, let's meet Cameron Malin. Cameron, how are you?
Doing great. Thanks for having me.
Good. Wonderful. Well, I want to get right into it. First of all, I want to thank you. Thank you for being here. Your time is valuable. And it's a pleasure to have you. I want to talk about your background when you were at BAU and exactly what you developed. And even if you can't get into specifics, tell us what you did there.
Yeah. So I came into the BAU in 2012. And prior to that, I had been an agent in Los Angeles for 10 years from 2002 to 2012. And I was a cyber agent, which was really great. The program, cyber program in Los Angeles, is robust. It has a lot of really complex cases. And as I was working those cases and really enjoying that process of really complicated intrusions and malware, I was noticing there were certain things about these offenders that were unique. And at a certain point, there was an opening in the BAU. Now, there wasn't a cyber component in the BAU. There's respective units in the BAU, if that's something you want to touch upon, but there wasn't a cyber unit per se, right? And so I applied through a different process, got over to a unit that had a national security component to it, and that's where I landed. And about, I don't know, maybe 2 months into that time, we were getting ready for training. So when you get into the unit, you receive a certain set of training, which is really specialized, really fantastic training, probably the best I've had in my career. And very soon thereafter, I was told, hey, are you up for standing up a cyber component within the units? And you know, that's a huge deal. And I was very excited about that. And we created what's known as the Cyber Behavioral Analysis Center, which was initially resident in one unit, and then it moved over to a different unit and kind of became its own unit around 2015-ish or so. So it has a lot of different elements in there.
All right, Cameron, now you're going to have to break all of that down, the general overhead.
Yeah.
And tell us how you solve cases and how you all worked to create profiles infusing sort of this cyber element. Tell us about that.
Yeah. So cyber behavioral profiling, it's not much different. If you think about like general profiling, it started in the BAU in the mid to late 1970s, which was the behavioral science unit at the time. Yes. And the idea of behavioral profiling goes back, if you want to go back into the mid 1800s, there was Hans Gross and other criminologists that were applying psychology to offenders. Cyber behavioral profiling, what the Cyber Behavioral Analysis Center does, or the CBAC as it's called, is it's looking at offenders' behaviors that are within digital spaces. So it could be volatile data that is in memory on a computer. It could be the disk of the computer. It could be online network-based things, social media, It could be files or applications and how you interact with them. Devices, how do you create countermeasures within these, or anti-forensics within these. And the actual files themselves tell a story, whether it's the actual content of the file or the metadata or the processing history and sort of the origin story and processing of a file. So there's lots of areas that, from a criminology and criminalistic standpoint, show a user's interactions, thoughts, feelings, beliefs, attitudes, all the things about us as humans render differently in digital. And so that's sort of the origin and how that type of assessment works.
And then now take us into at least a shallow dive into one of your more interesting cases, or how you put that all together to help a case either be solved or to help in the sentencing or in the adjudication.
Sure. So in I would say from both Los Angeles and the BAU, you know, I had a lot of exposure to a lot of different cyber cases. There were some, like in Los Angeles, that we had one case with 100 subjects that was international with a different host country, different law enforcement organization, that ended up being a massive takedown of a phishing enterprise functionally. In the BAU, you have a lot of exposure. Yes.
Explain phishing, because there's going to be people that think you're talking about trout instead of P-H-I.
So phishing can work in a lot of ways, but it's basically using deception and technical elements to cause those that receive an email that appears to be legitimate when it's not. And depending upon what they're trying to make you do, it could be clicking on things, links, attachments that cause malware installation to happen, or it could be to defraud you, to enter credentials or sensitive information that causes you to be defrauded. In the BAU, you get a lot of exposure to a lot of different types of cases. So I was lucky enough to work cases that were national security. I was lucky enough to work cases that were criminal cyber. And then sometimes other units had a particular offender that was a violent crime offender or a person of concern that had cyber elements about that case, whether it's what they're doing on a device, what they're doing online. And I was brought in, team members were brought in to help assist with those cases to understand that offender's interaction in that digital environment.
I could tell you, for me, whenever I had an issue with a case, and there were three very particular cases that I was running into dead ends, I immediately sent everything I could to the BAU or Behavioral Science Unit. It took me forever to stop calling it that.
Yeah.
To change over when they change their acronym. But nevertheless, in all three of those instances, they absolutely pegged the offender just with the information, the verbiage that was used, particularly in threatening letters on one, I can think, just unbelievable. How does that happen? Is it because of all that you do in the background to say, listen, I've got 100,000 people that acted this way, so likely this one's going to act that way?
Yeah, it's a really good question. And there's some demystification there. I think a lot of the way assessment is done is based upon how rich the information is that you get, right? You can't do a good assessment with poor information, and you can't certainly just guess and fill in blanks that you have. Certainly personal experience and expertise is going to come into play, but that is only as good as the data that you're assessing with that expertise and experience. There's a lot of science that's behind it. I know that, you know, over the years, there's been a lot of push and pull on whether or not behavioral profiling is a science, not a science, is it an art? And there's a little bit of both there. Modern behavioral profiling certainly takes into account, number one, as you've referenced, there's a lot of research that's done that is used to support behavioral assessments. And then there's structured professional judgment tools or instruments that are used to help structure information and use your experience and assess things through that structure. And then there is sort of the behavioral science base that we're all given. So we have that initial training, and then we're trained all along. There's opportunities to learn and be mentored and get training, specialization training that really informs the way you assess. So for someone like me, maybe I'll do a lot more that's online-based training, forensic-based training. Whereas someone that is doing crimes against children based behavioral profiling, they may get more training in abductions and other types of child-based crimes. So you get trained. It's an evolution. It's a ongoing beginner's mind, right? You have to keep sharp. And so you have to keep that beginner's mind of always looking at the state of science and how it can best support assessments so that they're accurate.
Well, Cameron, it's so interesting that you say that because you are a world-renowned expert. You were recently in London. You are who was called upon. No, no, no. Don't be modest.
Don't make me blush on camera here.
I know a lot here. But yet someone with your expertise, your knowledge, your training still seeks it every day. I tell you, every time I talk to you, you're like, yeah, there's this new, I'm looking into this. We just talked about one related to the David Burke case.
Right.
Which is more well known as D4VD. We're going to get into that now because I know many of our listeners were completely entrenched in that case. Just for a quick background, the body of Celeste Rivas dismembered. And yes, I'm going with that. I've got multiple reports about that. It was reported from that from KTLA early on. And plus, I did my famous demonstration. You cannot have, we're the exact same size, same height, same weight. You can't fit somebody in there and close that trunk unless they are dismembered. But nevertheless, I want to get into the fact she was 14 years old when she would have died and found in the trunk, frunk, it's the front trunk, which on Teslas we call those frunks, of the Tesla of David, parked literally around the corner, if you will, from his mansion, and parked there right before he took off on tour. Like, it's parked there, and then they all head out on tour. And then later, much later, she is found deceased when somebody has the vehicle towed because it's been there too long. And then an odor emanates, so they call police, and they finally get in there and find her. So that's what we're going to be talking about. I specifically want to talk about the Tesla. And I know you've just got back from some training on this. I want to understand, I have one, everybody knows that, on the Sentry mode, it records everything. But if I turn that sucker off, it doesn't record anything. And I do that to save the battery sometimes. So tell us, why don't investigators know who parked that? Why haven't we seen charges? It's been months.
It's a really interesting question. When we initially talked about topics and things, and when you mentioned that case, that one is an interesting one because a Tesla has so much onboard technology. And when we think of vehicles, particularly Teslas, like a Model X from that year, Model X is the high premium model trim level of that vehicle. Modern vehicles have something known as an infotainment system. There is varying degrees of what is captured on these. Teslas in particular have a lot of different data that's captured through this. It is stored on a secure digital high capacity card. So, and the operating system of this onboard unit, or MCU as it's sometimes called, it's a variation of an operating system. I won't get too geeky here, I promise, but there's an operating system known as Linux, and it's a variation of a Linux operating system. So it's very sophisticated for a functionally a rolling computer that has all these different components on it. But there is ways of retrieving this data from an infotainment system. And so even if you turn off Sentry mode, which is the surveillance video camera recording, you're still going to get a lot of data about the vehicle. You're going to get telemetry data, movement. You're going to get what's called track logs about the speeds and trajectory of the vehicle, whether you open a door, close a door, connected Bluetooth. It is looking, vehicles are looking to optimize user experience and also safety, right? So these respective areas of the computer are supporting all of these systems. But to do that, it has to have ways of saving data. It has to have ways of optimizing the logging and keeping these things straight so that everything runs smoothly from a user experience standpoint. The other thing that Teslas do is they have what's known as OTA, it's over-the-air transmission. And so in combination of all these things, whether it's the onboard infotainment system that can be forensically acquired and then forensically analyzed with special software, there's the over-the-air going back to Tesla. It would be hard to believe that there isn't digital evidence relating to this vehicle's usage. And even to your point, Jennifer, even if there's not the Sentry data showing someone walking up to the vehicle and opening something, opening the frunk, there would be data about the frunk opening, the time and date that happened. If this was abandoned, and the big thing about digital data is overwriting of the data. And so in this instance, if it's abandoned, the concern about overwriting doesn't exist. It's going to be on the SD card that I referenced. It's going to be part of that infotainment system package. If it stays in place, the risk of that is non-existent or low, I suppose, but more likely non-existent. And so it is interesting from the context of cyber behavioral profiling, why would you not exploit this data from the vehicle that is so robust? Of all vehicles, I would venture to say that some of the most robust data on an infotainment system would be on a Tesla.
So talking about that, tell us about how you extract that. You talked about a particular program and some training you had, and I'm curious whether the LAPD, who you feel has a very, an excellent cyber program,
yeah,
could it be something though that is so new that they aren't properly trained and weren't able to extract?
Yeah, I would venture to say, knowing that group, and it's been obviously many years since I was in Los Angeles. I was in the BAU for 11 years and then have been retired from the FBI for about 2.5 years. But they have a sort of reputed digital program there. Their cyber program is very robust. They're well-trained. They're well-funded. And I would be very surprised that they don't have that capability, know of the capability, and certainly in Los Angeles with the partners there, FBI, with the CART teams or computer analysis response teams or the regional forensic computer labs, the RCFL, it would be very surprising that that capability wouldn't exist.
So do you think this is a matter of the fact that there are batteries on Teslas that run the car? That's this huge, gigantic, multi-$1,000 battery.
Yeah.
And then there's the little battery that runs all of this other stuff.
Yeah.
Went dead, Cameron, what's the chance of that information being retrieved?
It should be very high. Again, there's certain things that are ephemeral data. Vehicles have a local operating, a local network known as a CAN, that's like the local network that operates on a bunch of what are known as ECUs. I don't want to get too geeky here, but the actual infotainment system or the module on the system that is able to store the data is on an SD high capacity card. So even if the battery is the little battery that you're referring to is removed, that is persistent data that is written to this disk. It's not written, it's not in memory, data or ephemeral memory. If something's unplugged, that data is no longer resident. It leaves memory. I'll give you an example. It might be that on your computer, let's say you're on your computer right now, Jennifer, and you have something in your clipboard, you have something you're connecting out someplace and there's remote connections. When you turn off your computer, that data goes away. It's known as in RAM or in memory data versus data written to your hard drive. And so it's the same thing with the vehicle. Removing the battery shouldn't affect what's on the SD card. It should only be the things that are communicating through that CAN or the area network.
That is so interesting to me. I think I shared with you, my husband was in our Tesla and got locked inside because the little battery had to be replaced. He was fit to be tied at, you know,
yeah,
8:00 at night. So I know the battery has a lot of power, but it doesn't have the power you're saying to affect what is recorded. So likely they're going to have a lot of information from that Tesla.
They should, unless something went catastrophically wrong or some intentional effort to remove the data. I mean, those types of things, it can be done. But even that tracks data there, right? There's been instances where those drives have been removed and or the batteries have been removed or there's been tampering, but that also leaves an impression in the written data evidence. It will show that there was a removal of the battery or an event as it's logged, depending on the vehicle. Again, all of these infotainment systems are a bit different, but even by virtue of trying to destroy data, it creates data, if that makes sense. It's like a Locard's principle of exchange.
Yeah, and it's wonderful because you can say, just like with Brian Koberger, yeah, he turned off his phone during the time of the murders. So that gives the person hearing that a lot of information, even though the information doesn't exist. I want to move on to specifically David's online present. He has said, my whole world was online. His friends, who he interacted with, he said that was his life, that was his world. And so I was curious, after everything happened, her body was found, he stopped all his touring, canceled all dates here and abroad, and basically sequestered himself in Texas with his mom, transferred all his belongings over to his mother, his property belongings. My question to you is, was somebody with this huge, gigantic, robust of a online presence, can he erase it and have it not be found?
It's an interesting question. You know, when you talk about destruction of evidence, especially digital evidence, it's going to be contingent on a bunch of things. Number one is how far and wide is this these sources of evidence? Number two, how was the evidence stored? Number three, what is the sophistication of the person that is trying to destroy the evidence? Do they have the capability or the willingness? Is he open and willing to destroy the evidence? Does he have the technical capability, or can he get somebody that has the technical capability to do it? The other thing is, you know, unless you're specifically aware or trained or otherwise know about these sources of information, like a mobile phone or a computer, or even online data, you may not be aware of the places that data is hidden or data is stored, whether it goes remotely, whether it stays resident to the device. And unless you have all of the awareness and capabilities to look for this data and eliminate it, it may be a bit of a an effort that may not work anyway, right? He may say, oh, I'm going to erase my phone, I'm going to delete files. Well, deleting files isn't going to erase the data. So it really comes down to the type of evidence, the breadth and scope, and how much is out there, where it's located, and the user's capabilities and willingness are usually the factors I would look at.
So we're looking at a case here where there should be prominent information from the Tesla, and she was found in the Tesla. We're also looking at a situation where he had a magnificent online profile, unlike many other individuals or, you know, possible criminals, people who are possibly committed a crime like this that have zero, some right. People have zero. So why do you have just a thought as to why in the world this is taking so long to determine who's responsible?
It's a great question. And I think, you know, your question may somewhat inform the answer is if in fact this person has this much data, the hardest part about coming to a charging decision is getting through all the data in a meaningful way that informs the charge, if there's enough evidence to support a charge. It may be that in reviewing all this evidence, there's still outstanding questions and they're doing more criminal process to acquire that evidence, or they're trying to dispel things that may not support charges. So they might be looking at other people or a bunch of people. It depends on exactly what happened here. And I think I would surmise that based upon the complexity of some of these evidence sources, they would want to dot their I's and cross their T's and make sure they have all of it, because it's such a voluminous amount of data and technical data. And so presenting that to a jury, presenting a lot of technical data, has to be done in a way that is digestible and accessible to people who may not be particularly technical. And so those take a lot of time, especially if this is a protracted series of events that you really need to meaningfully timeline out.
Well, I found it interesting and the right move, of course, that they did not try to charge anyone in this case by criminal complaint, and certainly not by an information, because I don't think anybody's really being very cooperative, but rather chose to go before a grand jury. And again, this has been weeks ago, and they're pulling people before that grand jury that are at best hostile witnesses and at worst complicit. So still we have nothing in the case. We have a manager who was before the grand jury, and let me know if you've ever had to do anything like this, for 3 days. In my largest, most complex T3 with 50 individuals we charged, I think I was different times no more than 1 to 3 hours per time, never longer than that in a grand jury. What do you make of that?
Yeah, I mean, you've nailed it. If you have to bring a lot of witnesses before a grand jury that are not going to be cooperative, whether they're invoking, whether they are just making it difficult for the prosecutor to get the information they need to support the indictment, if it's complex data that they have to introduce, it would sound like, you know, this is going to be a longer grand jury process. Especially you're dealing with somebody who is not necessarily, you know, maybe household famous, but there's some pressure, I would imagine, from the prosecution to get this right, because of if it goes to trial, they would want to be sure to have their I's dotted and their T's crossed. So I think it's a constellation of the types of evidence being introduced, the types of witness being introduced, and the level of how fast you can get through that information in front of a grand jury. And I don't know how they have that scheduled. I haven't looked recently at how they're scheduling grand juries, but you know, that could also be weekly. It could be only on a Wednesday they're doing grand jury, right? So it depends on scheduling of the grand jury as well.
And I want to bring forth, in case you didn't join us from the beginning, again, Cameron Malin, not only a cyber expert, profiler, but attorney, and he was an assistant United States attorney. So he's not only speaking with his cyber hat on, that's why I'm asking him a couple of these charging questions, because we're speaking with somebody who handled federal charges.
I was a state prosecutor, assistant state attorney. Yeah.
Apologize, yeah. I always thought you were federal. Apologies.
I was a special federal at the end of my career, but my position was with the Miami-Dade County State Attorney's Office, and then the last 2 years, a special AUSA. Yeah.
Okay, that's where I was remembering. Yeah. Special AUSA. All right. So now we've got both, which to me, the state prosecutors, they handle even more cases than the federal prosecutors. And they certainly handle more cases like this, which is potential homicide, dismemberments, violent crime, than you're going to see the United States Attorney's Office handle. So that leads me to my last question on David, and we'll move on to another topic that I cannot wait to get your input on. But on David, what kind of person, remember, 14 years old, we don't have any pictures of them sexually involved with one another, but we have multiple pictures of them together and them sort of hiding their relationship. And of course, a lot of witnesses saying they were involved physically. So you have, in other words, somebody who's a pedophile, if we're to believe this information. And then we have the girl ending up dead in the front. Remember, this relationship was at least approximately 3 years long, 11 years old, first met online. According to reports, there's a teacher that was interviewed too. So we have some good evidence and statements that are tangible for us. I'm not talking about source reporting. I'm talking about that we've been able to see. So my question to you, what kind of a guy, if he's responsible, does this? Let's just make the leap that he's going to be responsible for this crime. What kind of a guy does that? What's in his head?
Well, if you're talking about the totality of everything that has gone on in this case, and if he was romantically, you know, involved with, she's a child. So now you have somebody who's victimizing a child in many ways and manipulating circumstances to his benefit, and then ultimately taking her life. This is a particularly problematic person. And that isn't even including any other sort of behaviors we know about him. But if we were to tie all of those things together, you're talking about somebody who is, you know, from a paraphilic interest, and that is not my specialty. That is certainly more my wife's specialty. Yes. In looking at crimes against children, you know, it's problematic. I don't know their origin story or how long. I believe that they had known each other a few years before she was murdered. So that would place her around 12. If we're using that math, it's problematic. It's, you know, she's a minor, she's a child. And, you know, the science, the law, everything points very clearly that, you know, that's victimization of her, let alone ultimately her dying a horrible death at the hands of him or whoever is responsible for this. It's quite cruel. It's callous. And it's, again, there's a level of manipulation, of taking advantage of a child ultimately to harm her.
Yeah. And it's really been interesting to watch some of the items, right? Chainsaw, the burn cage that was recovered, apparently not used. Some of these items that have been discussed by a PI that he says is so horrific, you can't even imagine their plan that they didn't actually execute. How I took that was maybe he saw things, but we know from the evidence it didn't happen. In other words, she ended up in the frunk, not as it looks like there might have been a blueprint to commit. I mean, when you look at that, I just want to see it from the lens, from your lens, when you're thinking about saws. And in other words, and I know your wife is definitely, and I can't wait to have her on, the child exploitation expert, but still from a profiling expert, is this just about getting rid of evidence when you're talking about dismembering, like has been my experience in the types of cases I've worked, and then possibly burning them and then changing your mind or it not coming about? Or is this much more evil?
It can be a combination of both, right? I've seen cases where there is dismemberment and burning, and there is a need for that offender to get rid of the evidence. And so they're using tactics that in their minds will eliminate evidence. And so it's a counter forensic technique of burning and or dismembering to make the person into pieces so they can get rid of the pieces so that they're not traceable. But then depending upon really what we know about the person, if we learn that there is pleasure taken into that, or it is something that is enjoyable, or the suffering is enjoyable, and it has nothing to do with mere evidence disposal and counter forensic or anti forensic purposes, and that there's a enjoyment in that process, there's a cruelty, there's a relishing of suffering, then you're moving over into an area of sadism. And so there isn't, to my knowledge, enough evidence to support that type of finding. But to your point of what kind of person chooses to do these things, well, number one, it's a person that's looking to dispose of another person after they've killed them, which is already in the area of instrumenting and instrumenting violence, and then choosing to do it in a way that would bring gratification. You know, now you're moving over into sadistic if there's evidence that supports that. And then I've seen cases where it is burning and it is dismemberment, but it is truly a practical thing the person's doing out of self-preservation and not being detected and not getting in a position where they're apprehended or identified as the person responsible. So there's, I think, a number of degrees. I think for the sadism piece, you would want more information and evidence to support his thoughts and feelings and interests in causing the suffering versus a practical yet troubling way of just disposing of remains.
Okay, last question on the David and Celeste Rivas cases. We await, hopefully soon, a return of an indictment by the grand jury or no bill. We're waiting something. But my question to you is, The fact that he parked that car so close to his house, the fact that he disposed, or when I say he, I'm going to caution myself here. It's believed, right? He's been named as the subject of the investigation. It's believed he's totally innocent, but it's believed. Why park the car that close? Why dispose of a body in your own car that's easily going to be traced back to you? What is the thought process in other cases you've had where you've seen something like this? Is it just complete idiots? Is it grandioseness? Is it our narcissism, or just an idiot?
It could be a number of things. I think you've touched upon something that is sort of confounding here, and it goes towards the larger timeline mosaic we have here. Is it information to the contrary that it is all of these things don't lead back to him, right? That's why he hasn't been indicted. That's why it's taking so long, and that's why someone parked the vehicle right next to his house as if they're trying to attribute this to him. So I think that is a confounding factor. I think let's go with the working theory that you just asked, which is let's presume it's him and he parked the vehicle right next to his own location. What could be the cause of it? There can be a number of things. Number one, it can be panic. It could be that, doing this, there was a moment, maybe there was a fear of detection. Maybe there was a fear of identification or attribution, and it was a quick stop, and then he goes on tour, which I think were the facts after this happened, and it's located, he's on tour overseas. The other thing is, while he's doing it, that there's something interrupted him and something caused this not to move forward any further. So not only aside from a panic situation, there's some practical factor that just interrupted what he's doing, and he wasn't able to fulfill further distribution or dumping of the remains. So it could be just a very practical interruption thing that happened. The other part that I think is worth exploring, which is someone else did this and then left it there, making that causal attribution to David and putting the onus on him because it's his vehicle parked near his place with a person he knew, right? It allows investigators to kind of focus in that direction. I do think it's worth addressing the grandiosity part that you mentioned there. Grandiosity in this context would be an inflated sense of self-worth, somebody who has the ability, special abilities, special privileges, somebody who is not measurable or worthy of scrutiny or to be lumped with normal people. They deserve certain things. They have are in a rarefied air, and therefore normal things don't concern them. They aren't measurable in that way, and that I can of course get away with this because I'm this person. That could be in play again with any situation like that. We would want to have more data, right? When we start looking at grandiosity, there are different ways of measuring somebody's level of grandiosity. There's an instrument for that known as the narcissistic personality inventory, or the MPI-40. And that's for sort of a more clinical diagnosis. There's statistical information that support that. But then there's subclinical narcissism. And that's what you might be talking about, which is that it isn't diagnostically narcissism or narcissistic personality disorder within the DSM, but it's somebody that has a pattern of this grandiosity incommensurate with their successes, and it is at a subclinical level. So I think that could be in play. I think to attribute that here, I think we'd want to know more about his history and sort of the factors we would look at through the lens of the MPI-40.
Great. Thank you. Thank you for that analysis on David Burke. All of us are awaiting some sort of decision, so I appreciate you weighing in on that. I want to move on to how, and I'm just going to say it as easy as I can. How can what you do, how can profiling in this digital way either discover an individual before he commits a crime or try to diagnose other individuals that are capable. So basically, I want to get into your howler versus hunter, and I'll bring one to stage that you know also well.
Okay, so let's unpack some of this. So to address that, the howlers versus hunters, this is based off of work that two particular specialists in threat assessment, Calhoun and Weston, came up with in 2016. It was published in their 2016 book about howlers and hunters in threat management and assessment. Calhoun also did research back in 1998 looking at howlers and hunters. But the concept essentially is that there are people who don't ever intend and are not taking behaviors on a path to intentional violence and are directly communicating threats or unusual comments towards a particular target or people around that target that get to the target. So they're communicating about things, but don't have the behavioral intention to commit violence and aren't on a pathway behaviorally towards intended violence. Hunters are those that are not doing that kind of communication, and they are on a pathway and taking behaviors to prepare to perform an act of intended violence. So there's sort of the distinguishing between a howler and hunter, and it's based off of Calhoun and Weston's work. Those that are interested in the space, certainly their 2016 book is fantastic and still holds. A lot of research has been based off of their theoretical models. As far as to the question of, say, Nicholas Cruz here, you have on the screen. With Nicholas Cruz, he very much, his case and others were part of me looking at cyber behavior for intended violence. And I developed a model known as the Cyber Pathway to Intended Violence, of the CPIV, that's in the International Handbook of Threat Assessment, second edition. The idea being that in cyber, I was seeing a lot of different things behaviorally that might be different than on the ground behaviors. And so when you look at, say, Calhoun and Weston's model, the Pathway to Intended Violence, which was 2003, and there's things that support it before then. There's some of Fine and Voskuhl's work from 1998 that support it. There's some things in cyber that you just don't see in on the ground behaviors. It could be that there's this stage in my pathway known as conceptualization. And Nicholas Cruz really was one of the main areas that I teased that concept out of, which is that sometimes offenders are considering violence. They have an intention to do violence. They have ideated or have identified violence as a way of resolving a grievance they might have, but they're not really sure exactly how they're going to do it yet. And so in, let's call it November, December, January. So be November of 2017, December 2017, January 2018, Nicholas Cruz was very active on his phone. He was making notes to himself. So he would consider, you know, I want to kill people. I'm not sure how yet. He would give himself sort of mantras about, you know, how he could use his breath to control his breath and shoot correctly. And he was also taking videos on his phone about how he was going to be the next school shooter. He took three particular videos 6 days or so away from the actual murders. And he was kind of describing what he was going to do, how he was going to do it. So in many ways, he used his device from not only the motivational to ideation and intention, but he was forming ideas about how he was going to do this horrible mass shooting, eventually coming up to the conclusion he was going to get an AR-15. He then did research on the AR-15, and he moves on to research and planning. So he moves past that stage. So he was very much one of the main areas that I looked at for this stage of conceptualization. In terms of your question about how can this be used in a preventative way? Well, you know, there's a lot of cases that if the data is acquired before a violent attack, it can inform some of these stages and inform and to serve as signals of premeditated violence that are going to happen. A lot of that, though, is contingent upon people reporting it, getting it in the hands of law enforcement, having law enforcement look at it, and having law enforcement take action upon it. So there's been a number of cases where some of this data is found after the fact. For instance, the data I mentioned that was on Cruz's cellular device that was exploited after all of this happened. There were a lot of behaviors that cued that, you know, Cruz was a problem. There were a number of police reports. There were a number of anonymous tips. Really concerned about this guy. But the digital artifacts I'm referring to were part of the analysis after, unfortunately, that he did his horrible acts, and that they were able to retrospectively look back and go, oh my gosh, you know, he was searching these things. He was making these notes. He was making these videos, and it informed kind of the pathway he was on, but all too late.
So then help me out here. What is law enforcement right now? What are people at BAU, boots on the ground at the state and local levels, what are they doing to identify these types of individuals from the cyber aspect? In other words, are people having their items looked at, or does it really take somebody coming forward and saying, listen, this guy's acting weird, and then they have to move forward from there?
Yeah, so a lot of it is that pre-offense behaviors that are warning signals that someone is moving down a pathway to intended violence. And the BAU is easily the Behavioral Threat Assessment Center, BAU1, is world renowned. It is sort of the central location of fantastic research, publication, training, standing up and helping other behavioral threat assessment and management teams around the country and around the world. In terms of the technology, the personnel, the training, the capabilities, they're second to none. They really have been, and they've been in that position for many, many years. They're the leaders in this space, and you know, not only on their own caseload, but again, there's a incredible sense of pride and altruism to help others set up successful programs. They also leverage the greatest and latest in technology. And so that, you know, whether it's distilling information online and using AI and using sentiment analysis and social listening and aggregation of data to inform their assessments, you know, they're this is a shrewd, very, very educated and expert group. And so they're going to use whatever tools that have been grounded in science. They're not going to use things that are, you know, kind of the next coolest looking thing that has no empirical or substantiated efficacy. They're going to use things that are sort of known to be effective and then put it within their tool chain. And then they have the human capital, the human personnel of experts that are going to properly interpret these things. So that's what makes them so special and so successful at what they do.
Okay. So from the layman's point of view, are you telling me that there are people that are looking at social media posts that have AI that they can utilize to sort of bring them to their attention, and then they are trying to analyze whether we have a howler or whether we have a hunter? Is that happening?
So I certainly don't know if that kind of tool chain that you're describing exists. That would be beyond my knowledge. I don't know if they have like a, I don't want to say an assembly line, but like a process like that. The BAU in itself is not assigned to kind of be sentinels on the watch on the internet. They are the ones that receive cases that are persons of concern, and then they help assess whether there is a degree of concern with that person and help with the management strategies. But in terms of other areas of the FBI, law enforcement, other organizations that are adjacent to law enforcement that help do preventative analysis, the idea of using tools like that, using AI and going across the internet and looking for threats, whether it's the social media platforms themselves. Remember, they all have their own safety and trust groups as well. So I think what you're describing is more of like the larger monitoring picture that is ultimately distilled down if there's a person of concern, then it is referred over to the BAU. But the BAU is not kind of sitting on the internet looking for people and monitoring people. That's beyond the scope of what they do.
But somebody is at the local levels.
Yes, I would say pretty confidently that there's a number of organizations, both law enforcement proper and then adjacent to law enforcement, spanning all the way over to academia, spanning all the way over to nonprofit, and the content moderation teams themselves on these social media platforms and forums. Now, there are some like 4chan or 8kun or Nchan that aren't having that kind of moderation. People can report it, but some of these are known to be anonymous and don't have content moderation. So that also is contingent on the platform.
All right. One last case we're going to touch on, and I want to be very respectful of your time because your time is valuable and we so respect it here. But I want to talk a little bit about Peyton Gendron. He was involved in the mass shooting of 13 individuals. 10 ended up dying at a grocery store. Certainly a racist mantra, and a big online platform and manifesto, if you will, at least. Talk to me about that case. He's a hunter, obviously, I think. But would you have been able to identify that, not you, but generally the BAU, if he would have been called to the attention of your unit? How do you tell, in other words?
So the folks in BAU, and I was over on cyber, so I want to give all the respect over to the people in the Behavioral Threat Assessment Center who are doing that kind of work. However, if that case or a case like his, he certainly had a massive online footprint, massive. He was functionally doing his diary on Discord, which is an online platform. His diary ended up being around 600 pages. And this includes to-do lists of things he was going to do prior to the attack, posting handwritten drawings of his reconnaissance that he took while he was outside of Tops Market in Buffalo. He posted photos of himself wearing his pseudo-commando type of uniform and helmet. He was enamored with Breton Tarrant, who in 2019 killed 51 people in New Zealand outside and inside the Elnor Mosque, and emulated a lot of things that Breton Tarrant did, the way he wrote on his weapons. His manifesto itself is highly plagiarized. He had the manifesto online that he distributed prior to doing the attacks. And he also live streamed, which is also something Breton Tarrant did. Breton Tarrant live streamed via Facebook Live in New Zealand when he did the Christchurch mass shootings. Whereas Peyton Gendron used Twitch, which is an online communication platform adjacent to gaming, but it's used now just for live streaming, generally streaming. there's some conflicting information as to how many people were on the live stream that was averaged at 22 on Twitch. And then there was also the Discord channel that was set up. The video was captured and then promulgated that way through MediaFire, I believe it was. And so there was also belief that there were people logged into Discord watching live too, but that's where I think it gets fuzzy, is was it live or pre-recorded? Twitch was definitely live, and so he did the same blueprint and followed the blueprint of Peyton Gendron as far as having the live cam on his head, live streaming it, having the manifesto, plagiarizing high percentage of Peyton Gendron's manifesto, kind of emulating those same things. He, during his own diary and his manifesto, was open about how during COVID he sort of self-radicalized on 4chan, in particular Threads. So 4chan is an image board forum and it has pre-dedicated threads. So he claimed to be radicalized off of /POL or politics or politically incorrect, depending upon your interpretation of that. /K, which is weapons. And so the internet and his path are inextricably intertwined. There's no doubt that Peyton Gendron is a good example of cyber violence and that pathway and that evidence of that pathway being rendered into digital.
Yeah, I find it so interesting when we look at a case and you see it in the rearview mirror and you have the hindsight and you say, oh my gosh, this was everywhere. He was spelling out what he was doing. Do you have any percentages of the people that spell out things, the howlers, in other words, but they never do it? I mean, how do you tell? I think it would be hard.
Yeah, there's been a lot of research. I certainly don't want to misquote the stats, but I'll give you the kind of the origin of the statistics and kind of where they've gone. So, there were studies done. Fine and Voskuhl did a bunch of school shooting studies, and they were finding upwards of, I think it was 78% to 81%, that those that directed intended violence or said that they were going to do violence and were communicating what they were going to do or threats were not the ones that actually did the actual intended violence and followed the behaviors or pathway to an intended violence. So statistically, it's known that howlers are less apt to do violence and hunters are going to follow through. So studies after, I believe that was a 1992 study. Other studies have confirmed that. The BAU has done a bunch of studies. They look at sort of sequences in time. There's a great study on pre-offense behaviors in these shootings, and all of them sort of look the same way, to the extent that those that are making direct threats are usually not the ones that are following through and committing acts of intended violence.
So we just happened to talk about two that were howlers and hunters, and not about all the cases of people that are, you know, have this big platform threatening and do nothing.
Well, so I guess what I would say there, though, is that both Gendron and Cruz were certainly sharing, to some extent, more Gendron than Cruz. Cruz did a lot of his stuff on his device and didn't post it. He would post things about him dressing up or showing ammunition or showing knives or weapons, but there weren't as overt. It wasn't towards a particular person or I am going to shoot at this school and hurt these people. Cruz had a very odd thing where he would self-identify as a professional school shooter. He left that in a comment of a YouTube video. He would sort of sign off as that. He was committed for saying violent things. He had been in all kinds of kind of skirmishes at home, and there was concern about him that way. Gendron had his entire diary on Discord, so people who had access to that. And then it was oddly all collected up and posted on an online file sharing site. So he wasn't putting it out there on social media. I am coming to Topps Friendly Markets in Buffalo, New York, and going to shoot. He wasn't making a direct communicated threat. He was doing behaviors that were observable online that were signals of intended violence. I think that's kind of where I'd splice that hair is, yes, they were openly doing things, but it was behaviors leading to an actual planned intended violence, and they weren't directly contacting Topps Market or people that worked at Topps Market threatening them. Where a hunter, a howler, that's kind of the territory they would be in, writing emails or putting posts through their online portal saying, I'm going to come there and shoot everyone, versus Gendron, who is taking all the preparatory steps and doing behaviors escalating up a pathway to intended violence.
So that's what you're looking for. You're looking for action.
Yes. Behavior.
That matches the words or behavior.
Yeah.
Just the word.
Yeah.
And then another question here real quick on on these two, at the end of the day, correct me if I'm wrong, was the motive, am I wrong in saying this? I believe the motive of both is some sort of grandiose, look at me, I'm the man, I murdered, in one case, you know, minorities, black people, for the most part. I think he also killed two white people. And then in the other case, look at me, I'm a great school shooter. Isn't at the end of the day, it's their sort of their failures in life. If you can't be famous, let's just go with infamous.
It's a really interesting comment. There have been studies, again, Fine and Voskuhl studied this, and there have been many studies after that that have not only incorporated Fine and Voskuhl's work, but have also done empirical studies and kind of looking at what percentage of people from these populations had thoughts like that or feelings like that. There is often a correlation with feelings of failure or rejection. I'd be remiss. I don't know if grandiosity really falls into that. The studies I don't think are as clear on grandiosity as much as the feelings of a failure, rejection, the need to kind of accommodate for that. And there's a high percentage of folks in those studies that self-reported, particularly people who, had those feelings. There's high degrees of depression, anxiety, kind of being in a bad mental place. The statistics on suicidality, very high. So not folks in a good place, but I would say that not so much grandiosity, but more about the failures, rejection, and the need to kind of get through that, and whether you want to consider that revenge or making things right in their mind. But there's these loss, feelings of loss, rejection, humiliation, not fitting in, those kinds of things.
And so then this is the retribution.
It functionally serves as that. Some have been overt about that. Cruz was overt in his videos that was kind of what he was getting. He also had major losses. Again, when we talk about loss in people's lives and kind of being in a bad mental place, he had lost his mom. He was constantly texting his ex-girlfriend, who wanted nothing to do with him and was kind of telling him, stop texting me. Even right up to the time he drove up to the high school and did the shooting. And those text messages were part of the trial. So he had a lot of different events happening, and then also just his disposition, personality, and the way that he was as a person was pretty bad. A lot of people referred to him as evil, and he was known to walk around and shoot animals and hurt animals with pellet guns. And the police had been called on him because of the ways that he was acting at home and in the neighborhood. He was on radar. There's no doubt about that. I may be a little off in the number. I think there was about 45 different police calls and reports on him leading up to this, that neighbors and family members, friends, people calling in and concerned about him and that he was going to do something horrible.
All right. I have a final question I tell everybody how to find you. And that is, and this is a big one, with what everybody does at BAU, and I understand what you're saying, when somebody gets put on the radar, they help departments and individuals how to deal with that person. Are they really a threat? You know, how can we manage this threat? Blah, blah, blah. But other than when they're put on the radar, how can all of the resources that are put into BAU, how can it be used to prevent? Because I think that's what people want to understand. Help us understand the preventive nature of the behavioral analysis unit, and not just that unit, across the board. Does it really help us to study others?
It definitely helps to study others. And I think that because of studying others and because of this really meaningful effort that the BAU has taken, particularly, again, the Behavioral Threat Assessment Center, they've looked back in time and history, right? They've looked back at all of these events and all of these individuals that have committed these horrible acts of violence, and they are learning about the different statistics and stages of what people do, and use that to inform operational assessments. And then it's also training others on those same things. I think the publications that come out with that, through that research process, Making Prevention a Reality is one of their really wonderful free publications you can find online. The pre-offense study of shooters is fantastic. All of those kind of help inform and also are really inspirational for people to not become bystanders, but what would they call upstanders, and report the things that should be reported if they're concerning behaviors. Again, the BAU is fantastic and, again, world-class threat assessors, but they can only assess information that is brought to them and that they can do the assessment on if people aren't reporting things and they aren't doing their part as upstanders to provide that information. It's going to be hard to do an assessment of that person to do that type of meaningful preventative threat assessment and management. And that's part of it too. So it's kind of a entire holistic way of from observers, upstanders, reporting, police, BAU, threat management team. It's kind of a whole holistic thing.
I love the word upstanders. All right, everybody, we have to be upstanders. Yeah, you know, we always say it, see something, say something. And to your point, then get it to the people that can try to make right. an analysis, and then that's how you prevent it. So that's the clear, to me, management of how people can be stopped before it started, when it's truly assessed and it gets to people like you who can help with that. Cameron, great discussion. We went past our hour a little bit. I'm sorry. You're just, to me, hanging on your every word. And it's always fun to speak with people who are 10 times smarter than me. I'm just trying to keep up. And I just really appreciate the conversation. Everyone, I linked in this StreamYard or in this YouTube every way to find Cameron, his book, his company, what he does. It's all in there. There are so many of you that are interested in quote unquote profilers. And this is an area with AI and everything we see. This is only going to be, in my opinion, this is going to be where it's at, using AI to distinguish people who might be a problem, sending those off to people like you and trying to stop crime before it ever starts.
Wonderful. Well, thank you for having me. It was a pleasure.
Thank you. Till next time.
Okay. All right.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Guys, Cameron was great. He's so smart. Really, really enjoyed talking to him. Hopefully, I got some questions out there that you all might have been wondering about. Certainly concerning the David case, what they might and actually might not have. But it seems like, at least according to him, and there's a particular program, I don't know if he actually mentioned the name, but he and I talked out offline about it. And I tell you, that program is something else to be able to extract everything from that Tesla. My only thought is, if they had the photos, and we know we have the photos from down the street, right? We know that they have video photo of the individual who parked the car, right, in the bright colored outfits. Why don't we have any movement on charges? And he touched on that. He said, listen, this guy has a huge cyber footprint. It takes forever to get through the digital analysis of all of that. So hopefully that answered a lot of your questions on the David case, Celeste Rivas. There needs to be some justice for Celeste, and I hope it comes sooner rather than later, because it's been way too long. I want to thank everybody for being here. We do have a doubleheader. Our second half, which is at 4 o'clock, is going to be with Cheryl McCollum, Zone 7. Love her. She just tells it like it is. We did not. I had her on and we discussed the Delphi case because I didn't agree with her on the Delphi case, but she was there in the courtroom at least a few days. And we just agree on, we disagree on that case. But I tell you what, we agree on a lot of other cases and a lot of other things. And if I surrounded myself around people that always agree with me, that wouldn't be a good thing. So I always enjoy everybody's input and we put it all together and do what we can in this true crime space. So until next time, I want to thank y'all. Thank you for the mods. Thanks for being on. I know this was a long session. Everyone, see you at 4:00. May justice be served.
Want to break the case with Jennifer Coffendaffer even more? Then press subscribe right now and join Jen on YouTube. Just search Break the Case with Jennifer Coffendaffer now.